Welcome to Crossroads of Culture and Christianity. I am your host, Jacob Jellison, joined as always by my co-host, Aaron Hoff. Today, we want to continue our discussion that we've been talking about the last few episodes where we talked about moral relativism, but last episode, we got into absolutism. This episode, we want to take that same topic of absolutism, but kind of show you the different views as it relates to absolutism. There's one view in particular that we're going to lay out for you and describe, and it's one that was made popular by Norman Geisler. The view is called graded absolutism, and we'll kind of give you a background behind that, what that means, and the proposal of that viewpoint as we go throughout this episode.
So in Geisler's, he actually wrote a sort of a, it's become a classic when it comes to Christian ethics books, and it's titled Christian Ethics, Contemporary Issues and Options. And in there, and he's not the only ethicist who will do this, but he has a view that he calls graded absolutism. And so just kind of to wrap your mind around this, he sees a sort of a hierarchy within law. And so you've got these higher moral laws and lower moral laws. And then he looks and he says, man, we live in a broken world. And because we live in a broken world that's filled with sin, sometimes we face situations where there's a conflict between various moral laws. And what do we do when there's a conflict between various moral laws? If there's an unavoidable conflict between the laws, then the only option we have is to break one of the laws. Well, then we have to choose to obey the higher law, the weightier law, and in a sense, disregard the lower law. And because we had no real option, God doesn't hold us accountable or doesn't judge us as guilty for breaking the lower law. To give an illustration, because that's kind of a mouthful, maybe a picture helps unpack that. You might go, what is it they usually run to, Brother Jellison? Something like World War II time, hiding the Jews.
Yeah.
And sometimes they would say, well, if the German soldiers, the Nazi soldiers come, you might have to lie in order to save the Jews that you're hiding. And so what you've done, you've obeyed the higher moral law, you preserved human life, but you disregarded the lower moral law, and that was to tell the truth. But because you kept the higher moral law, God doesn't judge you as guilty, and so you're good to go. All of the points, and there's a lot in here to be considered.
Yeah.
I mean, a whole lot. We're just going to take, for this episode, one of those points, and it's the middle point that he gives, and that's the idea that there are unavoidable moral conflicts. So the idea that you could face a situation where the only choices you had included something that would typically be wrong or sin. And so you could find yourself in a situation like that where there's no way that you can do the right thing. It's like almost anything you do, it's going to be something that typically would be the wrong thing or a sin. But you're going to have to figure out which law is the most important and just keep that one. But that whole premise that there are these kind of unavoidable moral conflicts, that's what we want to call into question today. And again, there's a lot of different points that we probably should raise and discuss, but that's the one we'll zero in on, the idea that there are these unavoidable moral conflicts. It seems strange to me, to consider that. And I guess if I'm going to consider it honestly, I have to look at his arguments. It's like, that's one of the things that you try to do if you're trying to understand and discuss and go back and forth with someone. You want to figure out why they actually believe this premise they believe. And for Geisler, why do you think that there are unavoidable moral conflicts? And he lays it out in his book entitled Christian Ethics, and he's going to lay it out in order and give about five different reasons why he believes in unavoidable moral conflicts.
Yeah. You know, there's several things that I think are fascinating too. For example, And I know we might get into this a little bit later. I don't want to get ahead of us. But like that example that you gave, talking about the moral conflicts, there's several things that you have to assume in order for that to be the case. One of those, the World War II argument that you mentioned, one of those things that, you have to, and this is whenever I was going over this with some of the students, this was a couple of the points that I brought out. One of the things that you have to assume, number one, is that you know the outcome. So what I mean by that is his argument is the two options that you have are either preserve human life or lie. And you have to figure out which is the greater one to do, which is the lesser one to do. And if you break the lesser one, you're fine. Number one, you have to know the outcome. So if that be the case, then he has to know, and this, don't get me wrong, the Holocaust was a terrible atrocity.
Sure.
Millions of lives lost. I mean, innocent lives for no reason at all. But not everyone that went into a concentration camp always died. Right. So for that to be the case, and I realize the probability is of death as opposed to life in a concentration camp is a lot higher. But the fact of the matter is you have to know that is precisely what's going to happen. So in other words, what I mean by that is if I choose to not lie and I choose to tell the truth, and for some reason the people that are hiding in my house get found out and they get taken, number one, I don't know what's going to happen to them. So I can't know that I'm actually preserving human life at all. And number two, if something were to happen to them in that situation, then I'm all of a sudden at a place where, at least from my opinion, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, I don't know that that makes you complicit in their death, because yeah, you're not trying to get them killed. You're trying to obey what is right and do what is right. And if that results in their death without your, I mean, outside of your control, that's not you being complicit in their death. That's you trying to do what's right and a terrible outcome
right
happens, you know?
Right. I want to, on Geisler's defense of this point, because he says there are, at the top of page 102 in his book, he has this heading that says there are unavoidable moral conflicts. And then for about a page and a half,
yeah,
he tries to prove that point.
Yeah.
That there are these, you just can't help it. There are situations that are unavoidable where there's a conflict between the moral laws and you have to break one of the moral laws. You
yeah
just can't help it. And at the end, so he's got five different points, and he starts each paragraph. He makes it real easy. He starts each paragraph with first, and he gives his first argument coming mm-hmm from scripture for why he believes this way. He says second, and he gives a second, third, fourth, and fifth. His last paragraph there in this section, here's what he says. There are many other biblical examples of genuine, unavoidable moral conflicts, but the foregoing examples suffice. For him, he feels that the points he's raised in this page and a half, they do a good enough job proving that there are these unavoidable moral conflicts.
Yeah.
Now, he does say there are many other biblical examples of genuine, unavoidable moral conflicts. I don't know what all examples he's thinking of.
Right.
You know, I don't know what's encompassed by that statement. What I do know are the examples he listed here, five different points from scripture that he feels prove his case. Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to deal with his question, there are unavoidable moral conflicts, I think one of the best ways in is just to take his biblical examples one at a time,
yeah,
and see if it holds the kind of weight he feels it does. And at the end of the day, honestly, for me, when I get done with this, I sit back and I feel like it's just a stretch to try to use the kind of arguments he uses mm-hmm to prove that there are these unavoidable moral conflicts. And the most interesting, if we get there, is number four to me. But we'll yeah start at number one, just kind of progress down through here quickly. But number four, when we hit there, to me, that one just kind of amazed me that he would look there and say, see, there was a moral law broken right here. Mistake. But and yet God used it, you know, because it, yeah, it couldn't be helped. It was unavoidable.
Right.
It's just amazing some of the things he uses to argue in here. But we'll consider some of these.
Yeah. The first one that he mentions is Abraham offering Isaac, I believe is the first one that he mentions. And he makes this point and he says, from Abraham's perspective, that was a conflict of morals there. Abraham needed to obey God, but at the same time, in order to obey God, it was going to consist of murdering, pretty much taking the life of his son to be able to obey God. And so he points to this as an example of his viewpoint, the graded absolutism. The problem, there's several problems with this. First and foremost, it's a very weak argument to use. And the reason for that is because I will concede this much. From Abraham's perspective, it probably did look like there was a conflict of morals at the time.
True.
Yeah. But if you go further into the story and you read the story and you see the outcome, you find there was no conflict at all.
Right.
You know, because he doesn't end up taking his child's life at all. Yeah, he's about to. He's wanting to obey God, and he's about to do it, but he's stopped before he gets to that point. And so there's really no conflict at all. God didn't allow Abraham. The fact that God didn't allow Abraham to kill his son is in agreement with what the moral law teaches about murder being wrong. And it goes to show that there was no conflict of morals there at all. Even though it appeared that way from Abraham's perspective, that was only because he couldn't see what was actually going on. He couldn't see the bigger picture of things. So for a limited time, Abraham has to wrestle with, do I take the life of my son or do I disobey God? What do I do? You know, and that's it. But it, in the end, we see that there was no conflict at all.
Right. That's a great point to make, because, and it gives us a chance to maybe clarify exactly what we actually believe.
Yeah.
And when I look at this story of Abraham, from the outside, it looks like one way at the beginning.
Sure.
Okay. I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was Kierkegaard who wrote a book and years ago. And in this book, he dealt with the story of Abraham. And, he switches back and forth. He talks about Abraham offering up Isaac as being almost a leap of faith, as it were, just kind of a jump in the dark, you know, and it's, he talks about Abraham that way, but every time he talks about Abraham that way, you know, he's talking almost from a third person perspective. It's like you're from a distance observing this.
Yeah.
And then he'll switch perspectives and speak almost from an inside point of view. And from the inside point of view, it's not a leap of faith, a leap in the dark. If you don't know God, it looks like Abraham going up Mount Moriah to offer his son Isaac as a sacrifice. It looks like, my goodness, what's he doing?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
But when you know the kind of God that Abraham's serving, and there's a trust that's established there,
right,
and you know he's a good God, you know, it takes that kind of leap in the dark element out. And you know, God has the best interest in mind. And he's from one perspective, if God actually had Abraham kill Isaac, now Geisler might have a point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the beginning of this thing, whenever Abraham is going up the mountain, and from an outside perspective, you're not on the inside. The relationship with God, you heard God, you know what God wants done.
Yeah.
But from an outside perspective, we're just watching Abraham take his son up the hill and he's going to offer him up. And that's all we know. It does almost look like there's some sort of a conflict.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's the very fact that there's a voice that'll speak and tell him to stop and not let him take his son's life that agrees with a verse that I've fallen back on in these kind of discussions sometimes. And I think it's fitting. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 says, there in verse 13, there hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. And I realize Abraham's situation is unique.
Sure.
You know, and so the dynamics of it may be different. But here, no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape that ye may be able to bear it. And I want to suggest that as one of my points in considering all of this, that at the end of the day, God always has a way of escape.
Yeah,
there's
for sure.
Always a way out, in a sense, a way where I don't have to break any moral law.
Yeah.
And it may be that sometimes at the beginning of the situation, I may not always know what that way out is,
mm-hmm.
but there's always a way to do what's right.
Yeah, that's right.
And so there's a difference between me not knowing what the way to do what's right is, and between there being no way
yeah.
that is right. And so with Abraham's story, at first, we don't know the way out. But as you read the story, God provides the way out.
Yeah.
There's a ram in a thicket. And I think if we're going to use Abraham's story, in this discussion. I think we have to be at least honest enough. The point you raised, I mean, that's it to a T. It's there's a way out.
Right.
There's no conflict in the end. The conflict dissolves. And as long as we follow the Lord, I think that's exactly what happens. Every situation, there's going to be a way that I can do exactly what's right.
Yeah, absolutely. The second one that he gets to is he gets to Samson, as he words it, Samson committing suicide. And so you're familiar with the story of Samson, how it goes. In the end of his life, he can't see. A young boy leads him over to the pillars of this great house where there's many people. And he knocks down the pillars. The place comes crashing down and kills more people, the Bible says, in his death than in his life. But he's also a casualty of that as he does that. And so Geisler is going to point, and he's going to make the argument that Samson is trying to kill the enemies of the Lord, basically, I think is the point that he's making. But at the same time, he is sacrificing himself, but he's committing suicide in doing that. And so that's argument that's Geisler's argument, is that he's conflicted, I guess, between what is it, the taking out of the enemies of the Lord and at the same time taking his own life. Is that basically how he
yeah,
words it?
He's so in his paragraph on the story of Samson, he says it contains a conflict of two divine commands.
Okay.
The two commands are Samson committed, and here's what he calls it.
Okay.
I don't like this term. I think he's being a little too free and loose with some of this. But he says that it appears Samson committed what appears to be a divinely approved suicide.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't like tagging what Samson did to suicide. I think there's a difference between what Samson's doing here and things I typically label suicide.
Oh, for sure.
Okay. So I think he's being just a little too free with that term. Samson's primary goal here is not to end his own life. It's not like that's his purpose.
Right.
You know, his life will be lost.
Yeah.
But I mean, if every time you do something that you know will result in the loss of your life, we call that suicide.
Right.
Then it's like, what do you do with the soldier boy who throws himself on the grenade to save his friends?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I don't like to put that on. If I call that suicide,
yeah,
then it's like, what do you call the situations where someone intentionally takes their life? And if we call both of these suicide, it either makes the one where the soldier boy gave his life for his friends look like, oh, that doesn't look like a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, or it really lessens the weight, the negative weight on this thing where people take their own life because they just want to end it all.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't think those are equivalent things.
No, suicide is a selfish act done not for any noble purpose, whereas in your situation that you gave, the soldier is doing it for a noble purpose.
Right.
And further, if you want to go, that's kind of a slippery slope to go down. And this is one of the points that I bring out with this, because technically, if you want to get technical with it, and I hate to even say this, but it's the honest truth, you would have to say the same thing about Calvary as well.
That's true.
Because Jesus says, no man takes my life, I lay it down.
Right.
And so you would have to say, if we're going to go down that route and say that everything where it results in you knowingly giving your life, or your life being knowingly taken away from you, you knew it was going to happen. If you want to go down that slippery slope, you're going to have to do the same thing with Calvary. And I don't think you want to do that.
No. And that's where I want to limit suicide.
For sure.
Using that term to, and apply it only to those cases where that's the intended goal,
right,
is to take my life.
Yeah.
Sometimes the life is lost as a casualty in trying to achieve another goal. I don't know that I want to rule those as strictly suicide.
No, okay? And one of the points to add to that, which leads us into another point, a big point of it, is intention is much of it.
That's true.
So it matters what your intention is. The soldier's intention in the scenario that you gave is not to die. His intention is to save those around him.
Right.
So he's sacrificing himself in order to save them. The intention is entirely different from, you know, doing that from somebody that's just like, I'm tired of life, don't want to live anymore, and take their own life.
Right. So that's the first thing. So that's the first divine command that he sees Samson conflicted between. His situation, he committed a divinely approved suicide. And he says, despite the moral prohibition against killing a human being, including oneself, the commands were divine and moral. You shall not kill. Okay, so he's coming from Exodus 20. Thou shalt not kill.
Yeah.
All right, so that's a divine command. And then he gets the other place is the idea of, and he puts in quotation marks, take your life.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is inferred, he says, from the fact that God answered Samson's prayer. Mm. So the conflict is, Samson, thou shalt not kill. You're not supposed to kill. And he puts in there, including the taking of one's own life, which in this case, Samson's life is going to be lost. And yet God answers his prayer and allows him to literally bring this building down upon these people.
Yeah.
And it's, as you mentioned already, he is going to kill the enemies of the Lord.
Yeah.
But Geisler's problem, and the reason he thinks this shows unavoidable moral conflicts, is because, yes, but nonetheless, Samson committed suicide, you know. But I think we're being too free with that term,
I agree.
You know. So I don't want to take that story and use that as a story that I say, okay, I guess he's right, unavoidable moral conflicts. I rule this more of a sacrifice than a suicide.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
He's trying to take down the enemies of the Lord who would oppress the people of the Lord. And so it's more of a sacrifice than a suicide.
And what's the most fascinating about using that in that sense is suicide always has a negative connotation because it always relates to a selfish act, right? That's probably the first time in Samson's life that he was doing something selfless.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he gets bad cred for it. It makes no sense.
That's so true. It's been fun looking at some of these arguments that Geisler uses. There are more arguments. We'll get to them in another episode and consider the rest of the arguments. At the end of the day, every one of the arguments is going to be similar, at least in my book. It looks like his case just doesn't stand up. And I'm left with the fact to conclude, if that follows through with the rest of the arguments, I'm left to only conclude this. That's that God always makes a way of escape.
Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to reach us, you can contact us at askthecrossroads@gmail.com. If you have any questions or comments you'd like to leave, you can leave those there. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do that by clicking on the description of this episode, following the instructions down there. Also, if you would like to leave us a rating on whatever podcast platform you listen to, that'd be greatly appreciated as well. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.